the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. Don't let the sun catch you lying, lying at my front door. Daddy's done turned salty, baby, you made him so. You can cry, cry, cry. Yes, baby, you can wail, beat your head on the pavement till the man comes and throws you in jail. Don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. You can cry, cry, cry. Yes, baby, you can wail, beat your head on the pavement till the man comes and throws you in jail. But don't let the sun catch you crying, crying at my front door. You done daddy dirty, he sure don't want you no more. When the moon goes down in the dawning and the sun comes up in the morning, don't let the sun catch you crying, 'cause daddy don't want you no more.
Time. to go. Well, I've changed my way of living. My time ain't your time no more.
Music right there from Wynonie Harris. And here comes the blues from his disc called Who Threw the Whiskey in the Well. Plus Louis Jordan in that last set with Don't Let the Sun Catch You Crying. All right, nice Louis Jordan tune. Up next, let's hear from T-Bone Walker, recording for the Capitol record label and Black and White sub-label. This is The Time Seems So Long, recorded 1949 by T-Bone Walker here on the Deep Blues Hour.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
I want to start today by talking about President Joe Biden's upcoming Supreme Court pick. As many of you have no doubt heard by now, the oldest liberal justice on the court, Stephen Breyer, is going to be retiring, and Joe Biden is going to get to pick or nominate, rather, a replacement, which is subject to confirmation by the Senate. Now, Joe Biden made a promise during the campaign that he would select a black woman, which would be, if confirmed, the first black woman ever on the United States Supreme Court. He confirmed that that's still the plan. Jen Psaki, his White House press secretary, confirmed it. And I believe Joe Biden has also been asked about it and confirmed that as well. The American right is now starting a campaign to make the case that this is extremely discriminatory and essentially racist to anyone who is not a black woman. In other words, the way that many are framing it, and we're going to look at Laura Ingraham in a moment, who's doing this, is if you are excluding anyone who is not a black woman, it is by definition discriminatory and or racist against those individuals. This is wacky. And as someone who is not a wokester and not into corrosive identity politics, I'm going to explain to you why these people are wrong. But let's first listen to Laura Ingraham.
Like everything else Joe Biden touches, his Supreme Court selection process is in shambles. Candidate Biden, he thought he was being really woke and so cool by pledging to nominate an African-American woman to the high court. But of course, he was also effectively discriminating against a vast majority of the adult population.
Uh-oh.
And now even liberal websites like Slate thinks he has himself in a bind, claiming that Biden's pledge has backfired and needlessly tokenized future nominees.
So let me remind you, I am not an identity politics guy. I have spoken out for a decade about uses of identity to silence or to exclude. You all, if you've been watching this show, listening to my podcast for a while, you know that. Let's go through this now in that context in steps. First of all, is what Joe Biden is doing unique? And the answer is no, it is not. Here is Donald Trump saying, I'm choosing between women only for this next seat. And the crowd cheered.
I will be putting forth a nominee next week. It will be a woman.
Right. It wasn't only Donald Trump who did this. Ronald Reagan did the exact same thing.
Polls continuing to show he runs better among men than women. Reagan took a dramatic step today to reach out for female support.
Now, I'm announcing today that one of the first Supreme Court vacancies in my administration will be filled by the most qualified woman I can possibly find.
Oh, whoa. Hold on a second. Now, you can say, well, they were all wrong to do that, David. Okay, fine. You could take that position. But were you actually saying it at the time, or are you saying it now that they already put women on the courts and you no longer really have to say anything about it? It's very easy now to say, well, they were all wrong. None of them should have done it. But that's not really the most important thing to think about. I'm putting for context that this is not unique. So a lot of the criticism of Biden is hypocritical. But the most important thing is the context that matters here. The Supreme Court was established in 1789. From 1789 until 1967, that's 178 years, every single justice was white and male. Okay? 178 years. And during that time, we had slavery in the United States for roughly 80 years of that 178 years. We had slavery of black people and an all-white male court. So it's okay and it's notable when we say, hey, we now have a black person on the court, which came in 1967 with Thurgood Marshall. It's not racist. It's not discriminatory. It's look at the makeup of the country and look at the makeup of the court. And at this point, with so many qualified black jurists, how have we not had one? It's okay to point that out. You're not participating in toxic and corrosive identity politics. Let's give another example. From 1789 until 1981, we had all men on the court. That's 192 years. Every single justice was a man. So it's okay and notable to say, given the history of qualified women lawyers, judges, here's finally the first woman on the court when Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated to the court. There has never been an Asian person on the Supreme Court, Native American, Pacific Islander, black woman, Indian American, etc. We don't need a court that exactly matches the makeup of the U.S. in every sort of demographic characteristic, nor is it even possible with only nine people on the court. But at a certain point, when you say, wow, we have 330 million people in the country now, the Supreme Court's been around more than 200 years, it starts to get weird that we have not had certain people on the court. Now, they start to play its identity over qualifications. They say, we're ignoring who are the most qualified people because we're focused on identity instead of qualifications. And again, that's a terrible argument. Once again, we're a country of 331 million people. If I were to say, or if Joe Biden were to say, I am going to pick the first former sports, current or former sports team owner who is a woman, we would say, wow, that's like a really small group. There's not a lot of female major sports team owners. It's like, you know, Renee Montgomery and Michelle Williams from Destiny's Child is a part owner of a team, and Jeannie Buss owns parts of multiple NBA teams. We might be saying, that's really weird. That identity designation is not appearing to be a pool of qualified people. Joe Biden is picking one black woman, and there are many qualified black women. There is no reason to believe that by saying I'm going to pick a black woman and it's going to be notable given the history of the country and the history of the court, there's no reason to believe that it's going to be a less qualified individual. You're picking from among the many qualified black women. It is such a non-story. And that's me as a non-woke non-identity politics person telling you this, but they're going to keep playing it up and they're going to make it into something that it is not. If you disagree with me, I would love to hear from you respectfully, of course. Okay. The U.S. Army, after giving so much notice and giving every opportunity for service members to go and get themselves vaccinated with the COVID vaccine, is at the end of the grace period. And the U.S. Army is going to start discharging COVID vaccine refusers effective immediately. NPR reporting. U.S. Army soldiers who refuse to be vaccinated for COVID will soon be discharged, the military branch announced yesterday, Wednesday. The Army said it will, quote, immediately begin separating soldiers from the service who refuse to be vaccinated or who don't have an approved or pending request for exemption. Secretary of the Army Christine Warmoth said, Army readiness depends on soldiers who are prepared to train, deploy, fight, and win our nation's wars. Unvaccinated soldiers present risk to the force and jeopardize readiness. Soldiers who are discharged for refusing to be vaccinated, quote, will not be eligible for involuntary separation pay and may even have to return unearned special or incentive pay. Now, the right is framing this as we are dramatically weakening. I don't know why I'm doing the Alex Jones voice. We are dramatically weakening the military. and we are going to be more beta rather than alpha in fighting wars, which they claim they don't want to fight anyway. But as of January 26th, as the article points out, 96% of active duty troops were completely vaccinated. 3,300 soldiers have refused. 5,900 have temporary exemptions. And those are temporary in the sense that their requests are still being reviewed. This is really not a big deal. It's time. You need a bunch of vaccines to be in the military. This is the latest vaccine you need. It's not controversial. We've gone through the list. I'm not going to do it again. Is it 10, 15, depending on where you're serving? It can be closer to 20 different vaccines that you have to get when you're in the military. If you won't follow a simple service-wide vaccine mandate that is like the 13th or the 18th or whatever, it's not unique. It's not, we've never had any vaccine requirements, and now here's one you've got to get. They all got in line for all the other vaccines when they enlisted. It's just time to say you're not fit for military service. Oh, I'm not taking this one vaccine because of my rights or my religion or come on, guys, come on. Now, one thing that I heard from some service members about, and I did a little research into this, and it does appear to be true, is a bill was passed taking dishonorable discharges off the table for vaccine refusers. So what I'm hearing from some of our viewers who are in the military is that there are people who have been sort of wanting to get out for a little while, and they're taking this as an opportunity. Now, again, we're only talking about 3,300 unvaccinated with no exemption right now. So it's like a tiny, tiny percentage of individuals, and some fraction of those may be refusing the vaccine, not because they're actually against it, but because they want a way to get out without a dishonorable discharge. So that may be a factor to some degree, but I don't think it's a dominant thing. But anecdotally, it does seem to exist from what I'm hearing. But there's really nothing controversial here. It is not going to affect overall military readiness. It's not going to affect in any material way the massive fighting force that the United States has. And it really shouldn't even be getting the attention that it's getting, because it's not never needed vaccines and now you do. Like I said, it's you always needed 12, now you needed 13. Or but depending on where you're serving, you needed 17, now you need 18. It's not a big deal and it shouldn't be made into one. And the military has been saying for a long time, this is exactly what we're going to do. And now they're doing it. It would be more of a problem, I would argue, if they said that this is what they were going to do and then they failed to do it. They promised this was the path and they're doing it and it makes perfect sense. If you disagree with me, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman. We're going to take a very short break. We really have a fantastic program for you today. Remember that the David Pacman Show does depend on viewers and listeners like you to support what we do every day, including our new thing, sending correspondents to Trump rallies and other political events to interview people, which I'll talk more about in a moment. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. Members get instant access to the bonus show. And the bonus show, you know, for years I've been telling you the bonus show is world famous, which is true. The bonus show is award winning, which is true. We give out the awards, but they still are awards. But now I can tell you and accurately tell you, this is the bonus show brutally attacked by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Right. I can think of no greater endorsement for the bonus show than the fact that Alex Jones has attacked it. And you can sign up at joinpacman.com. Coupon code, remember, Alex Jones called me a predator. New coupon code is Predator22. Okay, Predator22 saves you big bucks off of the bonus show at joinpacman.com. All right, a few notable posts on the David Pacman Show subreddit. Now, here I'm not selling you anything. Many times I am selling you things. Here I'm not. You can go to davidpacman.com/reddit, where nearly 34,000 of our viewers and listeners have subscribed for free, and you can post about the show. you can talk to other viewers and listeners about what's in the news. There's some things you're not allowed to do because it's a little bit over the line, but there's a lot of things you can do at davidpakman.com/reddit. One user posted, "On the Scene Correspondence has been my favorite addition to the David Pakman Show. Seriously, David, it's incredibly entertaining, but also wildly useful to get real feedback from these events. I don't know if Josh or Luke wind up being recurring correspondents, but I loved watching them. Maybe one of the larger events you or Pat could get out in the field, too." There'd be some security concerns. "Keep this kind of segment going." Yeah, the point is taken. The feedback to having two people on the ground in Conroe, Texas for the rally was fantastic. And the incredible thing is, because you all are everywhere, all over the country, it is very clear that if there's another Trump rally in, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, maybe, or wherever, or if there is a, I don't know, an anti-vaccine protest in wherever, I think that we now have the audience size where I can say, hey, anybody in Berkeley, California, or wherever, will pay you to go and interview people at these events. We don't have to fly people around. We don't need, you know, all these different things. And we can basically just take the money because we want to compensate these people for their time. That's the appropriate thing to do, as we did with the Texas rally. And we can say, well, because you're already there, the money goes for your time rather than having to put money into expenses. I think it's absolutely fantastic. We're going to keep trying to do it. And the one thing is, we need to know about the events early enough. It's hard to say, hey, can you go tomorrow? So in terms of Trump rallies right now, we're not seeing anything else on Trump's calendar. And we will see. But one of the most valuable things is when right wing media starts some new story, whether it's about Fauci or Biden or whatever, by having these correspondents on the ground, we can immediately see whether it's gotten to the Trumpists and whether they're aware of it and how they're interpreting the new talking point. So it's a fantastic thing, and we are going to keep doing it. Okay, another post on the subreddit. David should get in contact with Carhartt about being their spokesman. And there's a absolutely, I described, so Carhartt is a brand that has announced their employees are required to be vaccinated. And it's sort of a right wing associated brand. Now, I very I don't know that I want to say ignorantly, but I was having trouble describing what Carhartt is. And I said Carhartt is a popular clothing brand for people who are out doing work, chainsaws and whatever. I meant that it is a brand of clothing that I believe also has, it's not only warm, but it has like protective elements where I think the material is such that it has some protection if you regularly work with sharp objects. I don't know. Anyway, so someone made a funny image of Carhartt for people out doing work, chainsaws and whatever. But in all seriousness, Carhartt is not unique. There are tons of companies that require their employees to be vaccinated. And I think the reason that the Carhartt vaccine requirement triggered so many people is that there is heavy association between Carhartt and sort of working alpha right wing male ideology. But Carhartt's doing it. Carhartt has said you got to be vaccinated. And a lot of right wingers now burning their Carhartt clothing. Although what's funny is I think there are Carhartt items that are flame retardant because of what they're designed for. So it was actually a problem. It was difficult to actually burn it, which just makes it all the more funny. Join the discussion at davidpakman.com/reddit. All right. This next story is a very big deal. The January 6th Trump Riot Committee, the committee investigating the January 6th, 2021 Trump riots, is quite frankly doing a very good job of something that is very difficult. There are so many different aspects to the Trump riots. What was Trump up to in the time leading up to? What was going on within law enforcement? What were Trump's kids doing? What were members of the House doing? What were members of the Senate doing? Who knew what when? Etc. Records that need to be obtained, all these different things. The last 2 weeks have generated new evidence for the committee because Donald Trump's reaction to the committee's actions now appear to be witness tampering. And in fact, Congressman Pete Aguilar said on CNN yesterday, Trump is tampering with witnesses, which is again scaling up the criminality potential of what Donald Trump has been up to. So we have a CNN report about this. January 6th committee member says Trump absolutely tampering with witnesses as he continues to dangle pardons. Let's take a look at this video clip here.
That lawyer represents other January 6th defendants and said that Rhodes and others would welcome a Trump pardon. Is Trump tampering with witnesses when he's talking about pardons, when he's dangling them in front of 1-6 defendants?
Absolutely. And I think the question is more for my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, you know, where are they? Do they support this? When is enough enough? When a mob is chanting, hang Mike Pence, it wasn't enough. When the former president asked Brad Raffensperger to find him 11,000 votes,
true,
it wasn't enough.
Right.
Now he's, you know, dangling pardons if he gets back in office for individuals. Will that be enough or will there be more collective amnesia? You know, I just don't know where the floor is these days on that.
Where is the floor and what is the bottom or however it is that you want to describe it? And what's being referred to here, and what's funny is this isn't even the first time that Donald Trump is dangling pardons in a way that could be seen as witness tampering. Remember that back with during the Russia probe, where you had Paul Manafort, Carter Page, Roger Stone, all these different people being investigated and interviewed and many subsequently charged for lying to the FBI or different things. Donald Trump did the exact same thing. He talked about those who are staying strong, and he talked in a circuitous sort of roundabout way about the possibility of pardons. It could have been argued at that point, and many legal experts did argue, that's a form of witness tampering. You were signaling to these individuals, if you don't cooperate, I may pardon you in the future. If you don't cooperate, there may be good things coming. And if you do cooperate, you're going to be on the list of bad boys, so to speak, and you're no longer going to be in my good graces or whatever the case may be. Here, Donald Trump is doing a very similar thing with the Trump rioters themselves. It's different because there's a really good chance Trump is never going to pardon any of them. And this is sort of like multi-step. It's not at all clear that Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee in 2024. If he is the Republican nominee, it's not at all clear that Donald Trump will win the presidential election in 2024. If Trump wins the 2024 presidential election, there is no guarantee that he will actually pardon any of these people. And so not only is it another attempt to potentially influence the behavior of the rioters and of those, and this is an important addition. It's not only about influencing the behavior of the rioters themselves in their cases, but also of Republicans, more so in the House, but in theory in the House and Senate and other people around Trump in general about cooperation with the committee or the Trump rights. It's a bigger signal, but it's not even clear that Trump really intends to follow through on this. And you can make the argument, as Pete Aguilar does on CNN, that it is a form of witness tampering. Now, the obvious question is, well, so should we expect a criminal referral to the Department of Justice? It is not because Donald Trump will go to prison. I maintain Trump is not going to prison. But at what point do we say the facts just point to there should be a criminal referral from the January 6th committee to the Department of Justice, and then put it on the Department of Justice to decide we will or won't investigate, we will or won't charge, put it on Merrick Garland to actually sort of be pushed into having to do something when it comes to this? When is enough enough? And consider with Hillary Clinton vis-a-vis Benghazi, endless hearings, special investigation, hearing, report, all these different things, demanding charges, demanding Hillary Clinton be locked up absent any charges, ignoring their stated principle of the value of due process and constitutionality and the rule of law and order and all these things. There wasn't even anything there, and they were saying lock up Hillary Clinton. It seems at minimum here, there is more than enough evidence and factual basis for a criminal referral to the Department of Justice. And then let's see how the Department of Justice deals with it. I don't expect this to stop. And we continue to follow the now more than 700 cases, 700 defendants in the Trump riots, now almost 13 months to the day beyond that date. The sentences are starting to come in, and we will see where it ends up. But without a doubt, this is arguably another instance of witness tampering. And if you're Trump, if there were no repercussions to the earlier witness tampering with the Russia probe, why would you behave any differently now? Of course you wouldn't. And that's part of this entire thing. We'll have that clip of Congressman Pete Aguilar on our Instagram. You can find that at David Pakman Show. We're going to take a quick break. And we've got a really interesting interview coming up, not about the 1%, but about the 9.9%. What does that mean? It's a very interesting group culturally and economically. And we're going to talk about that after this short break. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Matthew Stewart, who's a philosopher and author of several books, including most recently, The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. Really appreciate having you on, Matthew. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
So we often hear about the 1%. We hear about the 0.1%. We hear about the bottom 90% many times, or the bottom 50% in discussions of economics and society and culture. What is significant about this 9.9% that made you want to study and write about it specifically?
So let's not forget that the 0.1% is actually driving the wealth inequality, and the bottom 90% is the group that's losing. So there's two interesting things about the 9.9%. One is that it's actually holding on to its wealth. So that's, I think, really important. And then the other thing is that it plays a much bigger role in driving our values and our culture. So that's, I think, what makes them especially interesting, because I think we're all part of it, even if we're not financially part of it.
Can you talk about the ways in which that group drives culture?
Yeah, I mean, so for example, in education, it's pretty straightforward. You know, the plan for making it into the 9.9% today is to go to college and go to a good college and get a good degree and so on. And that kind of plan made a lot of sense when college was inexpensive, when a lot of it was publicly paid for. And when there were jobs for people who got those kind of degrees. But all those realities are gone, and yet the value system is, if anything, even more entrenched. So there's even more emphasis on you can make it if you just go to the right college and you sort of figure out how the system works. And then it turns out, of course, that the people who succeed in that are the ones who already start with a leg up, whose parents are already in the 9.9%.
What are the economic what's the line for entering that group, that 9.9%, in terms of where is the 90th percentile in terms of income and wealth, and where, how far up does it reach?
Yeah. So but let me also just qualify and say that, you know, we don't want to get too fetishized about the numbers because they move. And also, it's not just about the numbers. It's sort of about relative proportions. But, you know, basically, you need about $1.2 million in net worth to make it into the top 10 decile, or the 9.9% of the wealth distribution. And your income should be in the 120,000 plus range. So that's what kind of gets you into it financially. And then at the top end, obviously it's different as you get to the top, but about 20 million will push you out the top in wealth, and, you know, sort of 500,000 or so in income, which, you know, sounds like a lot, but in fact, when you compare it to the very large sums that are going into the 0.1%, it's actually pretty small. So it's a group is more homogenous than people like to think.
Now, what's interesting is certainly, I would guess, the vast majority of the bottom half of that group would consider themselves middle class, and many who live in the most expensive cities would absolutely insist that they are middle class. Is that culturally relevant that so much of that group considers itself middle class? And is it accurate in some sense?
Yeah. So what's happening is the hollowing out of the middle class, but the ideas are about, you know, 20 or 30 years behind the economic reality. So a lot of people in this 9.9%, even in the bottom part, they don't get how wealthy they are relative to the rest of society. They don't quite get how much better they do have it. And of course, part of the reason why they don't get it is because they're also being stressed. I mean, it's pretty hard to stay in that group. You have to work really hard and, you know, get some lucky breaks and be in the right place at the right time and so on. So I think there's a significant misperception in the group, which is how wealthy they are. And a lot of this shows up in surveys. You ask people, you know, how much do the people at the top make? And they say, oh, well, you know, the average CEO makes $1 million a year. And of course, that's preposterous. And the average CEO makes $17 or $18 million a year for a top 500 company. So I think there's a lot of misperceptions. And the one you mentioned, the middle class delusion, is a really big one.
Can you talk a little bit about the racial makeup of this group that you're describing, generally speaking?
Yeah, I mean, pretty simply, it's mostly white. I mean, it's about 90% white, as against, you know, depends how you measure it, 65 to 70% of the general population. There definitely are people of color in the 9.9%, a significant group, but in relative to the representation in the total population, it's significantly lower. So I think the black share is about 1.7%. of the 9.9%, as against about 13% of the general population. Latinos roughly similar.
In terms of political power, I mean, we understand the dynamics of money and political power in the United States, generally speaking, but that top 9.9% is much bigger in terms of population by definition than the top 0.1%. In terms of aggregate power, and that doesn't mean it's being wielded effectively, but in terms of aggregate power, what is the power dynamic between that top 0.1% and the following 9.9?
Yeah, it's the 9.9% presents this big political problem, especially for the Democratic Party, frankly, because that group now is leaning blue. It's not completely blue, but it's more so than the general population, whereas the top 0.1%, notwithstanding all the nonsense about limousine liberals, actually functionally leans very much to the right. Mm-hmm. And the dynamic between them, it's a really great question. It's, you know, on the one hand, the 9.9% is fundamentally dependent on the 0.1% economically. But on the other hand, culturally, there is a big gap, and a significant part shifting left is aware of that and tries to pull away. The big danger for the Democratic Party and the left is that this group, which is, I think, has a disproportionate weight in left politics, doesn't necessarily understand or share the interests of the other 90% of the population. So they tend to skew the left in ways that can be ultimately go against the interests of the large part of the population and sort of work indirectly for the top.
Oh, that's interesting. So let's see if we can think about that a little. So you've got, so the top 0.1% is leans overtly to the Republican side, and it's sort of clear that the economic interests of that group in terms of the policy they want is not good for the bottom 90%. It sounds like you're saying with this, the following 9.9%, nominally, these are folks who identify more as Democrats than Republicans and believe themselves to lean more left than they lean right. But maybe without even really knowing it, the policies they want or the status quo that they reinforce is also not good for that bottom 90%.
Yeah, I mean, a classic example for me is the real estate game. So the we don't actually pay a lot of attention to that this issue in national politics, but it actually drives a lot of our culture, and it drives a lot of the issues that we have, this, the huge segregation, economic and racial, in our neighborhoods. And the role of the 9.9% in that, I would say on aggregate, is really pretty regressive, because what it ends up doing is saying, oh, the issue isn't, you know, our neighborhoods. The issue has to do with, you know, any number of other things, you know, personal prejudices, with education, with, you know, economic policies that interest us more. But in fact, the 9.9% tends to ultimately come down very heavily in favor of very restrictive zoning and other very restrictive land use policies that drive up the price of housing, that have created an affordability housing crisis, that reinforce segregation dynamics, that reinforce educational segregation dynamics. And so they end up being, you know, very regressive. And it's something that the 9.9%, I think intellectually, the more self-aware members are onto this, but functionally, the way they actually act, ends up, you know, reproducing these divisions that in turn increase inequality and work to the benefit of the 0.1%.
One of the things that often comes up in conversation with people who do well but are not in the top 0.1%, and maybe not even in the top 1%, so maybe we're talking about 90th to 98th percentile to kind of imagine, again, you know, as we're talking about, these are not exact delineations, but there's often the feeling among the 90 to 98% that, hey, the very top doesn't pay enough in taxes, and we do need to do things for the bottom 90%, but also the taxes are a little too high on us, the 90 to the 98. Can you talk a little bit about that dynamic and really where some of these lines should be in terms of taxation?
Yeah, so there's a grain of truth in that. It turns out that the real tax rate, when you throw it all in, you add the federal, state, and local, you look at capital and income and so on, the real tax rate for at the very top is lower. It's dramatically and absurdly lower than it is for the upper middle class and so on. So vis-a-vis the 0.1%, yeah, the 9.9% is getting screwed like the rest of society. There's another side of it, though, that's a little harder for people in the 9.9% to grasp, and that's that our tax system is so arcane and complicated that it ends up indirectly subsidizing a lot of people invisibly. So, you know, a classic case in point is the mortgage interest deduction. But there are many other bits and pieces like that that have the effect of subsidizing the 9.9% in ways that are kind of invisible. So people in that group think that their taxes are actually higher than they are. Another, going back to real estate, that's another kind of invisible subsidy. We have, notwithstanding the fact that we do have property, municipal property taxes, we basically don't capture the implicit rental value of real estate. And so people who own their own homes end up getting an indirect tax subsidy, but they're completely unaware of this. They think they're geniuses for having bought into the real estate market when they did. And so they're kind of unaware that some of the money that's coming their way is really an indirect tax subsidy. So it's a really complicated picture. And of course, you know, I'm sure you'd agree, if we could wave a magic wand, we'd replace the current tax system, have something radically more progressive and a lot more fair.
Yeah, I've had very interesting conversations with folks who say, you know, I don't really make that much and I'm touching the 33% federal tax bracket. And then when I live, if I live in New York or California or Massachusetts, then, you know, you're throwing 5 to 10% on top of that. And I'll often say to these folks, listen, you don't have to tell me exactly what you make, but understand that you're touching that top 33%, but not all of your income is taxed at that, because we have, you know, these are brackets, marginal tax brackets. And then you've got your standard deduction. And you have a mortgage and you've got, you know, all these different things. You should really look at that first page of your 1040, which says total tax, divide it by your income, and you are going to find a shockingly low number. And many times it's 17-18% federally overall. And these are folks absolutely in that 9.9% who themselves don't really have an understanding of the degree to which they are paying federal taxes.
Yeah, but let's just not forget that. I mean, the big money is at the very top.
Of course.
And the big solution here
absolutely
is actually to go after the.
Yeah,
the
ground. Another two or three points for someone making $180,000 a year has almost no impact compared to what we're talking about in the 0.1%, without a doubt.
Right, right. But then let me also mention on the other end, because this is something that happens when we talk about the 9.9%. We forget about people that are at the other end of the economic spectrum. We don't think about sales taxes as a big issue, generally, if you're
right.
A member of the 9.9%, but that's actually a pretty significant hit to a lot of people with lower incomes. We don't think about the FICA, you know, the payroll tax deduction, but that,
right.
You know, if you've got a minimum wage job, that's a big chunk of your income. So things are much more regressive than people understand in the 9.9%.
Without question. The book is fascinating. It's called The 9.9%, The New Aristocracy That Is Entrenching Inequality and Warping Our Culture. We've been speaking with the book's author, Matthew Stewart. Really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, great to be here, David. Thank you.
All right, let's talk about the patriarchy a little bit. This is probably the favorite topic of my audience. My audience just loves talking about the patriarchy. No, that's not true. So we're going to look at a clip. It's an interesting clip. Jason Whitlock was on Tucker Carlson's daytime program. Now, the difference between Tucker Carlson's daytime program and nighttime program is that Tucker wears less formal clothes on the daytime program, but it's just as wacky. It's really no different. Jason Whitlock is a journalist who came from the sports world and has become more and more of a cultural critic. The right wing really has taken to Jason Whitlock. He's sort of like an anti-woke, tell it like it is type guy, and the things he tells like they are as he sees them are very often wrong and extraordinarily reactionary. And Jason Whitlock on the Tucker program talked about how not only is he probably a sexist, but that the patriarchy is a good thing and sort of like it's all good because we need to keep women in their roles. Now, this is a clip from 2022. It's not a clip from 1952. And I know many of you might say, wow, the video quality is so good for what we would expect to hear in 1952. No, this is from this week. And Tucker Carlson, Tucker seems to know he can't agree with the guest openly because that could be problematic for him. But he does the thing where he says, that's not an opinion you're allowed to have right now. And so he's kind of like indirectly saying like, wow, that's an opinion you can really get in trouble for. But I don't disagree with it one bit. So let's just get into the clip and then we'll kind of pause as needed.
But I probably am a sexist pig, so I could care less if I'm called that. But the patriarchy is...
Now, he should be saying I couldn't care less. You would think a journalist like Jason Whitlock would know that, but that's okay. This isn't about that. It's about the substance.
Good thing. It's what God intended. Men are supposed to lead. Men are supposed to be out front, taking risk. We're responsible. I have some ministers on my show every Wednesday, and we talk about it all the time. This is if you have a biblical worldview.
It's shocking that the ministers agree with the patriarchal view, huh?
In the garden, Adam and Eve, when things go haywire, God shows up and calls out, Adam, where are you at? Hey, basically he says, excuse my language, shit ain't right here. Adam, what are you doing? I left you in charge. And that's, God is looking down at us right now, at men, and just, what are you doing? Why are you laying down? Why are you pretending that Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, Stacey Abrams.
How do none of them know how to pronounce Kamala Harris, by the way?
That they can save us. They can save this world. This is lunacy. It out of her role completely. And I'm sorry if that paints me as a sexist pig, but it's what I believe.
Well, that's just an epithet designed to make you be quiet. But I guess I...
Right, listen. When you talk about how these women are not fit to lead because they're women and that they're trying to be out of their roles, when people call you a sexist, they're just trying to silence you. It's just an epithet. What?
I wonder why is that? Why are you not allowed to have that opinion? Why is that so controversial? That was the opinion of every society, like from the beginning of time until about 20 minutes ago.
Now, that is actually what I want to focus on, what Tucker says there. There's this bigger movement about the natural patriarchy. And this is a movement that wants to explain what might appear to be unfair inequality when it comes to gender or discrimination against women. They want to explain it away by saying there is a natural patriarchy, whether it's biological or genetic or whatever the case may be, neurological and stuff. That this is a very important movement, and they wrongly believe, the way Tucker Carlson says, that it's always been the way of humanity until, as he says, 20 minutes ago, until the woke era, until recently. And it's just not true. Now, as many of you know, I have no interest in repeating tropes and talking points on this show that aren't true. So, for example, when you don't hear this anymore that much because, I don't know, society has moved on. But remember 77 cents on the dollar? You would always hear women make 77 cents on the dollar compared to men. It wasn't true. And we studied it. And what we found out was that women made about 91 cents on the dollar. Now, it's still an inequality, and there's a lot to look at. And it's, well, what are some of the reasons why that is? And let's explore it. And what portion of that is due to discrimination on a gender basis? And what? Listen, let's explore all of it. But I'm not going to repeat 77 cents when I know it to be 91 cents. OK, so I have no attachment to any of these talking points. The natural patriarchy thing is just not true. First of all, if you just look in the modern era on jobs, there is no evidence that women are less capable of jobs and social positions that men predominantly hold. I'm totally open to exploring interest level in some of those positions among gender lines. And when we talk about, well, there's certain jobs that men versus women are more interested in, I'm totally fine having the conversation as to whether the difference in interest is societally imposed by stereotypes or for some inherent reason. The right loves to say, oh, leftists don't want to ask these questions. Ask them. I mean, look, when you think back to the Larry Summers Harvard comment about something about math makes women less suited or like whatever he said, I have no problem exploring whether there is some basis on which women are less suited to math. I've seen no evidence that that's the case. And so if we don't have evidence, we shouldn't repeat it. But the idea that these things are taboo, they're not taboo for me. And there is no evidence that women are less capable of the jobs and social positions that men predominantly hold that I have seen. Now, it's also fine to acknowledge there are biological differences between men and women. Biological men don't breastfeed. Biological men can't get pregnant. But this idea of the natural state of the patriarchy is a lame one. And it is also a relatively recent thing. There's some very interesting evidence that patriarchal societies don't date back more than 10,000 years. Humans appear to have been significantly egalitarian for a very long time, if you go back and look further. And one reason that we suspect that is the relatively similar size of human males and females. Yes, human males are bigger than females, but the disparity is much smaller of all of the great apes. And that is a clue. It's not proof, but it's a clue that male dominance does not seem to have been as important a driving force in the development of humanity as people like Tucker Carlson and Jason Whitlock might propose. So, you know, it's not even clear I needed to give this much explanation, but the things which Jason Whitlock and Tucker are just kind of casually ranting about and citing God and, oh, well, you know, they don't allow you to say this anymore or whatever. These are topics of academic interest, and we do actually know more than what Jason Whitlock's pastor says or minister or whoever is on his show. So, you know, I don't know that there's much value in this program that Tucker does, but they actually are raising interesting topics. Their understanding of them is completely wrong, but these are interesting topics for sure. I want to look at a clip now of a radical Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene being interviewed by Alex Jones on InfoWars. Now, as many of you know, Alex Jones recently attacked me.
Thank your lucky stars every day. You're not Dave Pakman.
Right.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
So Alex Jones really doesn't like me, but he really likes Marjorie Taylor Greene. And that tells us a lot about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Marjorie Taylor Greene, in 1 minute yesterday, while being interviewed by Alex Jones, told so many lies that some are likening this to a psychotic break. This is a sitting member of Congress, guys. This is someone who is currently a member of Congress. And the funniest part is her starting by saying everything going on with COVID is mental illness. Let's take a listen.
This is truly mental illness.
Now, I know she said mental illness. She means mental illness, guys. Trust me.
Wearing a mask today after 2 years of this Chinese virus that has infected our country, this man-made Chinese virus that Dr. Fauci sent our tax dollars to and contributed to. But
she can bear, contributed, mental. It's just visibly struggling to speak.
People still wearing masks. I mean, it's truly mentally ill. We know the masks don't work and the vaccines don't work.
Now, both of those statements are untrue. Masks do work. those lame gaiters that people pull over their face and cloth masks don't work that well. If you've got two people wearing N95s, I mean, this has been studied extensively. If one person is infected and one person's not, and both are wearing N95s, the odds of transmission are very, very low. If people aren't wearing masks, the odds of transmission go up, you know, who knows how many times. I don't want to understate it, but they go up dramatically. Vaccines work. New data suggests that you are 97 times more likely to die of COVID right now if you have no vaccines versus if you have three doses. So what she's saying is not true. It's not even close to true.
People that are vaccinated are still getting COVID.
Now, of course, that's true, but it ignores the reality that if you're unvaccinated, you're 97 times more likely to, you know, it's exhausting at this point, guys.
But I think that people really have blood on their hands that have stopped the prescriptions of ivermectin, refuse people who have had sick family members in the hospital of not being able to take ivermectin.
Now, remember, ivermectin has not been demonstrated to be effective against COVID. I would love it if ivermectin, Z-Pax, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, whatever. I would love it if that was effective for COVID. These are cheap, ubiquitous things. I have no ideological opposition, but they've not been demonstrated to work against COVID.
Or any other kind of life-saving treatment or therapy. I mean, I truly think that we need to investigate all of these people and investigate the deaths that are reported on the VAERS system and hold people accountable.
Now, the VAERS system is another darling of the American right. Remember, anybody can report anything they want to the VAERS system. Well, but David, that would be against the law. People could get in trouble for that. Is anybody getting in trouble for the false reports? No. So anybody can report anything to the VAERS system. And even honest reports to the VAERS system about people who died 6 weeks after getting a vaccine, when you have hundreds of millions of people getting vaccinated, including elderly folks and sick folks, of course, some of them are going to die within 6 weeks of getting the vaccine, and they would have died within six weeks anyway. And it can have nothing to do with COVID, even, never mind the vaccine. So she's wrong about everything. She's, you know, Alex Berenson is sort of the wrongest man on the pandemic. Marjorie Taylor Greene is sort of like the wrongest woman on the pandemic.
Because it's Dr. Fauci and anyone at the CDC or anyone involved that stopped life-saving treatments and therapies and people died. Well, I think they're guilty of murder.
Right. Not giving ivermectin makes you guilty of murder. And by the way, why do all these right-wingers, instead of saying Dr. Fauci, they say Dr. Fauci? Why can't they just pronounce things the way they are? So Marjorie Taylor Greene, dangerously unhinged. And remember the messages. Member of Congress, one of 435, and almost certain to be reelected to her seat in Georgia. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192 David P. I am hoping that today we are closing the books on the me leaving the country saga. I was asked, if you left the country because things got bad, where would you go? And so I gave an answer. And then I was told, you're abandoning us. You're not a team player. I'm canceling my membership because I can't support someone who would just leave if things got bad. And I had to say, no, guys, I'm not planning on leaving. I'm not planning on leaving. I was asked, if you were to leave, where would you go? And then I was told, oh, but you sound like a Jew traitor, Jews who take their capital elsewhere. Okay, let's hope that this voicemail is the final note on this entire leaving the country thing.
To those people, to all those people that you say who contacted you via email,
yes,
to let you know their dismay, anger, disgust, but threatening to or actually canceling their memberships because they consider you to be some kind of a traitor, some kind of a Jew traitor, mm-hmm. abandoning your country, blah, blah, blah. At least half of those people would do the very same thing if they were able to.
True.
I think a lot of those people who express negative thoughts towards you in email are the people who can't leave because they're not able to leave. They don't have the wherewithal to leave.
That may be.
And they're angry and resentful for that. So there's that. I think you addressed the question quite well towards the end. You don't need to apologize. any normal person, if faced with extreme circumstances externally in his or her own country, would, it's that's just human nature. It's survival. Desperate people do desperate things. It's not a question of being loyal or patriotic. F*** that. We're a nation of strangers. If any country was a country, a nation of strangers, it's the United States, because the last thing we are is united. So don't let them trouble you. I hope you can make up any revenue you might have lost from those mukes who felt, because they can't do what you do, they have to be engaged in retribution and spite. F*** them. F*** them and the horse they rode in on.
Wow.
You do what you have to do. And by the way, that's not to say you can't continue your show, that you can't broadcast to people in America from a different country. Technology exists to do that.
Yeah, not only that, I've done it. And there have been stretches of time where I've been out of the U.S. and I didn't announce it because there was no reason to announce it, but nobody had any idea. It's not really a question of being able to do the show. So let's hope that that's the final note on this leaving the country thing. I have no plan to leave the country. We will talk on today's bonus show about the resignation of CNN's president over a consensual relationship with an employee. We will talk about a push to make the Lunar New Year a federal holiday. And we will actually talk about jury deliberations in the Roy Moore defamation case. Remember, this is the bonus show. Much maligned by Alex Jones.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Right. What an endorsement. And I invite you to sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access, and I will see you on.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth. The cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the WRCT Pittsburgh. Jazz is a one-syllable word.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
...of events that brought us right up to the edge of a real coup in America.
As Donald Trump openly admits he tried to overturn the 2020 election, we'll speak to Congressmember Jamie Raskin, who serves on the House Select Committee on the January 6th attack. He's the subject of a new MSNBC documentary called Love and the Constitution, which gives an inside view of how the Maryland Democrat responded to twin tragedies in the weeks after the 2020 election, the attempted coup, and the suicide of his own son.
We were not the only family in that god-awful year to lose a family member. If you add up COVID-19, opioid deaths, gun violence, and all of the other normal causes, millions of people lost loved ones.
Amen.
We are indeed surrounded now by American carnage.
Then to Chicago, where protests erupted Thursday over the early release of the ex-police officer Jason Van Dyke, who murdered 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in 2014, shooting him 16 times.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
We'll speak with Will Calloway, who pushed for the release of the police video of McDonald's murder. We'll also talk to Justin Blake, the uncle of Jacob Blake, who was shot by police in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Blake and Calloway were both detained last night, calling for federal civil charges against the officer. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's confirmed the death of Islamic State leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureishi, who reportedly died as U.S. warplanes, helicopters and special forces assaulted a residential compound in northwest Syria Thursday. Biden blamed Qureishi for the deaths of at least 13 people, including women and children, who were killed during Thursday's early morning raid.
As our troops approach to capture the terrorist, in a final act of desperate cowardice, he, with no regard to the lives of his own family or others in the building, he chose to blow himself up, not just to the vest, but to blow up that third floor, rather than face justice for the crimes he has committed, taking several members of his family with him, just as his predecessor did.
Witnesses described a gruesome scene inside the partially destroyed compound with six children and four women among the dead. Images showed remnants of U.S.-made explosive devices scattered near the site of the assault. Thursday's raid came less than a week after Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin directed the military to do more to protect civilians from harm in U.S. drone strikes and other combat operations. Russian President Vladimir Putin has met Chinese leader Xi Jinping for talks in Beijing, coinciding with the start of the Winter Olympic Games. It was President Xi's first face-to-face